Right, Acts chapter 17, lesson number 11 is where we're at tonight. Last one for 2021. I about done forgot the date already. We'll talk about probably the first part of the chapter. And as our custom has been, let us read. That's one of the shorter chapters. Let's just read the whole thing. Does anybody want to volunteer to read?
And when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul, as his manner was, went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned out of the scriptures, opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus, whom I preach unto you, is Christ. And some of them believed, or were persuaded, and consorted with Paul and Silas, and of the devout Greeks a great multitude, and of the chief women not a few. But the Jews which believed not, moved with envy or jealousy, took unto them certain lewd fellows of the baser sort, and gathered a company, and set all the city on an uproar, and assaulted the house of Jason, and sought to bring them out to the people. When they found them not, they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, "These that have turned the world upside down are come hither also, whom Jason has received. And these all do contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, one Jesus." And they troubled the people and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. And when they had taken security of Jason and of the other, they let them go.
Let's read the whole thing.
Okay. And the brethren immediately sent away Paul and Silas by night unto Berea, who coming thither went into the synagogue of the Jews. These were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind, search the scriptures daily, whether those things were so. Therefore many of them believed, also of the honorable women which were Greeks, and of men, not a few. But when the Jews of Thessalonica had acknowledged that the word of God was preached of Paul at Berea, they came thither also and stirred up the people. And then immediately the brethren sent away Paul to go, as it were, to the sea. Silas and Timotheus abode there still. And they that conducted Paul brought him unto Athens, and receiving a commandment unto Silas and Timotheus for to come to him with all speed, they departed. Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him, when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews, and with the devout persons, and in the market daily with them that met with him. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him, and some said, "What will this babbler say?" Others, "Some, he seems to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is? For thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We would know, therefore, what these things mean." For all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, "You men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you were too superstitious. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' Whom therefore you ignorantly worship, him I declare to you," or declare I unto you, "God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things, and hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. that they should seek the Lord, or seek God, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. For in him we live, and move, and have our being. As certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. For as much then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's device. In the times of this ignorance God winked at. But now commandeth all men everywhere to repent, because he hath appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he has ordained, whereof he has given assurance unto all men, in that he raised him from the dead. But when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, and others said, we will hear you again of this matter. Howbeit certain men claimed unto him, and believed, among the which was Dionysius, and Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them.
All right, thank you for reading that. Thought and discussion questions on page 36. Why did Paul and company pass through the two cities but stop at Thessalonica?
Could be because those cities were part of the region they were coming into, so they were basically trying to hit some of the key cities and then let the word spread from those centers. There are also some times where the Spirit didn't allow them to enter into certain places like Asia and things of that nature. So that's another thought.
I thought maybe it's because they didn't have a synagogue there.
And it could be because
I don't know how to prove that.
Well, it does specify though that when they came to Thessalonica, there was a synagogue of the Jews. So,
well, and what you first said there about it being the others being, I guess, support city, so to speak, of the other, of Thessalonica, that would play in the way Paul run things too.
Yeah.
Central location. And
you try to hit places at their core, and then the gospel spreads from there.
Yep.
Like, if Paul was alive today, he would be trying to hit New York, Los Angeles, major cities, and then, you know, other cities across the U.S., but he would be trying to hit major cities where the populace is very well gathered. You got more educated people in that area as well. Paul was not afraid to contend with educated people, as we see here in this chapter. So, yeah, he's definitely not afraid to go to places where the most people were in order to maximize the effectiveness in the original hit of the gospel.
It's just how many.
Also, you think about the buying, selling, the trade, the commerce. When 99, I think it was, when went back to Tanzania, the reason they picked the city that they picked to start from is because of the buying and selling. People came from all over to do business there in that city.
So people from all over get a chance to
eat. Yeah. Yeah, so and really that's the way it worked. I mean, that's the way, here we are 20-something years later, and that's the way they developed into 350 congregations or so. Is a lot of times it would people that would come, they would come to the city and they'd stay for a little while, and then they would learn the gospel, and then they would take it back with them and be wanting support. And then they, you know, want to go home and start a church, a church plant, as we say today, and the way it'd go. How many Sabbath days were they allowed to use the synagogue?
Three, it said.
Yep, three.
He reasoned with them for three, and then they got tired of it after three, I guess.
Well,
especially after several people believed in.
So three would be, three Sabbath days would be 3 weeks.
At least 21 days.
Yeah, you could either count it. You could either count it as 1 times 7, 1 times 7, and 1 times 7, or you could count it to where it's just about 14, 15 days. between the first two, one week spring, second week. So I'm not sure which way you'd go with it. Either way, it was still an extended period of time.
Depends on what day you arrived there. I mean,
that's
if
true.
Right, the first day of the week, it'd be exactly 21 days. The 21 days would be the maximum.
Yep.
As far as before they send him away.
Yep. And I like to think of it, too, as they didn't just spend one day there at the synagogue. I feel like they were probably there off and on, daily, in and out, all through that time to interact with as many people as they could, especially those that were the rulers or the teachers in the synagogue. Question two is, what was the subject of Paul's preaching in Thessalonica?
It's predicted in the Old Testament that Christ must needs suffer, and that he had to die as well and risen from the dead. And this Jesus, he went through all that, and I'm preaching unto you because of that. He's the Christ.
Yeah, here's your proof.
Major premise, minor premise, conclusion. It's a formula of logic. I never took logic, but I am aware of major premise, minor premise, and conclusion. Your premises have to be sound. If they're both sound, then you have an absolute fact for a conclusion. If they're both sound.
Also, it's the same message. Death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus.
Nothing
changed from what we've read in earlier passages. The same message. So what was the result?
Some believed.
Yep.
But it means the same thing. They
were and consorted with Paul and Silas. And noted, this is what I thought was neat, was, and of the devout Greeks, a multitude, and of the chief women, not a few. In other words, there were a lot of them. So there was a lot of people that, there's a lot of people that ended up believing because of them being in the synagogue. And it's significant that it supports the idea of what people say, or what we have said about the women usually believe before the men do. This verse kind of bears that out as well. What do you think about this idea of the chief women?
Somewhat greater respect than what people have sometimes thought that they had, but Greek people in the past did have a pretty good respect of women in their culture, more so than perhaps others. That's not to say, though, that they didn't do sinful things with women, because there was still temple prostitution and brothels and things of that nature in certain cities like this. So it's one of those things where people of noble intent and people of integrity that were of Greek society, just as it is in any nation under heaven, people have a halfway decent mindset. If they're not given over to evil, they usually try to treat their women with respect, and it shows you that there were women in their society that were well respected, had a position, had a certain amount of authority.
That's kind of what I kind of thought of it, too, is, talking about the chief women, it could have been the older women, the ones that were the, kind of like in the pecking order, so to speak, the older, the younger, or the older, the middle-aged, the younger, and then the children. In the Strong's there, it seems to find it again. It says something to the effect of the foremost in time or in place of order of importance is the way he defined it. And then Thayer's Bible Dictionary kind of held that same way, that was first in time or place, or first in rank, or again, kind of like an order of authority almost, or it kind of comes across that way, in the way they see it in the Greek there. Either way, it was women that would be able. I believe it was women that would be able to teach others also. You know, to be able to pass it along. I think that's why they were mentioned. I wonder if that's why they were mentioned.
And I think one of the reasons why Christianity spread so well and permeated society so well, there was even people in Caesar's household.
Yep.
That believed in the first century. And we're talking about during a time where some of these Caesars were pretty evil. I mean, Nero was extremely evil. Vespasian, extremely evil. Domitian, extremely evil. We're talking about emperors that just absolutely persecuted and put to death Christians. And yet there were people in their household that were believers. So it's hard to stamp out something when it's permeated every aspect of society, every dimension. And when you have women that believe, it's one thing to do this to men, but Romans and Greeks alike, they did not like seeing women put to death. So you're going to have a hard time stomping out Christianity, no matter how many men you try to kill, because you're not going to get all the men in the first place, but what men you do get, the women are going to try to continue on in the good work of preparing the children as they're growing up to believe.
Yeah.
And by...
just like the old saying, it says, you know, whoever rocks the cradle runs the country or the society.
And we don't think about this, but this was a big test. When Paul came to Thessalonica, just like any other city he visited, this was going to be a big test for them. Not just because, you know, if he would mention to the Thessalonians, they were highly commended for receiving the word in much affliction, much persecution right off the bat. It was instantaneous for them. And that happens with a lot of Christians today. Satan tries to pull them away just as soon as they're immersed into Christ, just as soon as they put on Christ and they're forgiven and walking in newness of life, he tries to destroy it. The Thessalonian church is a great example of how Satan tried to stamp out the church from word go, but he didn't succeed. It only fueled the fire. It only built them stronger. They had a firm foundation. Those that believed really did believe, and they were willing and ready to go through persecution pretty much from their infancy. And it's just as soon as they're starting off, their faith was strong enough to withstand some of the persecution they had to take from the very get-go. And that led to them evangelizing Achaia, Macedonia, and all the region round about. Like we were talking about earlier, it was a center, and they did exactly what Paul had hoped for. From them had sounded forth the word of the Lord. They had sounded it forth like a trumpet, sounding forth an announcement. And so they had great success. But yet, the chief women, I think, you know, these are women in respected positions in society, some of which would have been rulers of the city, perhaps even rulers of the synagogue. It's going to be hard to stop that.
Yeah, it's starting to turn into something. It's starting to turn into a movement. Definitely so. And by the next verse 5, we begin to see how big of a movement that it is based on their reaction.
Right.
And you know, well, the next question is, name at least 5 things that the envious Jews did.
Yes.
That they took certain lewd fellows, they gathered a company, they set the city in an uproar, they assaulted the house of Jason, and then they dragged him out, and brethren as well, to the rulers of the city. So that shows you when they're starting to get the local officials involved, at which these officials is going to get back to headquarters.
Yeah. All the things that they were trying to accuse them of doing,
they were doing. Just like
they're,
we see today.
Respecting law and order and authority. They weren't in a position where they had authority to arrest people for religious conviction, for a belief,
yep,
for faith. And so here they are, and they're causing uproar. They're causing unrest. They're causing these issues. And it was not for any greater good. It was only out of envy. And the Holy Spirit lets us know that from where go. It's the exact same motive that's attributed to the religious leaders that delivered Jesus to Pilate. It was out of envy that the Jews did that.
Yep.
That's what the gospel accounts say.
That's what the Bible says.
Three of them say the word envy. And Pilate knew it. Pilate knew, even he discerned that it was out of envy that they had delivered Jesus up to him. And so, yeah, it's a... Job tried to picture it like this as far as like the persecution that came. Let's say you're a Jew in this city. You're not a Gentile. Let's pretend for a second you're a Jew. And I'm a Jew. Right? And we're going to synagogue together. This man from out of town shows up and he starts preaching. And you wind up believing in Jesus. But I don't. And you see the test that's going to come there? Because there's going to be this pull. You're going to have to make a choice. Are you going to be faithful and attend worship? And this is something that was not normal for the Jews. Brian can tell you as well. The Jews were not used to fellowshipping and worshiping with Greeks. That is, Gentiles. This was not something that, as you may recall, this is something the Apostle Peter was hesitant to even do. Hesitant to go to a Gentile's house. Hesitant to baptize them. Until God showed that they are most welcome into the kingdom. Once that was shown, and once that, you know, started getting gaining momentum, then the Jews were more receptive to it. But even so, it was something new to the people of this city. They had never heard the gospel, so there was this internal struggle where people were dividing lines, you know. And they'd be like, son, if you keep going to this church meeting, I'm cutting you off. You're not going to have any part with us anymore.
A lot of persecution
came from it.
This is what Jesus was talking about in Matthew chapter 10, where in verse 34 he says, I think that I am not come to send a peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes shall be that of his own household. And he that loveth father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. And he that findeth his life shall lose it. And he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. And then he goes on to describe some more. But that's what we're talking about. The peace. The peace is not within a house because of the belief structure. Some chose to believe, some chose not to. And the situation you described is what he's talking about here. And we know that went on. It had to have gone on. Because we see it today, and people really hadn't changed. If you think about it. Notice that in this verse, in this passage, 5 and 6, they didn't just drag out the people of one house. It says they dragged out Jason and brethren, and the brethren out to the rulers of the city.
That's right. And then verse 9 of this chapter points out that they took security of Jason and also of another. It doesn't tell us who that other is, but there was another there that they took security of. That could be for multiple reasons. One, he didn't want his name known, and so Luke left it off. Or because he became unfaithful later. We don't know. We have no clue why Luke names one and doesn't name the other.
Yep, yep.
But whatever the reason is, we can respect the not knowing part. That's something we should always do with the Bible. But they wound up taking security of two of them, which means that they were basically taking pledge of them. They were making sure that these men were not going to cause any more trouble or any issue. And I'm trying to think of an example of that today.
Well, I also thought about, too, the reason they took security of them is it might have been they were trying to protect them.
And that's true.
Or they were doing something to show that they were doing something. Well, it was a bunch of somethings there. But, you know, if they put them in jail, they're appeasing the crowd. Yep.
Do you think this is talking about possessions, or do you think it's talking about a sum of money, or do you think this is talking about just a verbal pledge that we're not going to cause issue? I've always wondered about that because it never specifies.
Yeah.
I've always kind of been curious.
Well, if you think about it, the thing is, this was all voluntary. that like the people believe in and all that, that was voluntary. They wasn't forcing anybody. They wasn't dragging them off to gulags, re-education camps, or anything like that. This was of a, people were doing this of their own free will, and which with many movements, many things that become movements, that's the way it goes. People join them of their own free will. I thought about too that in this, in them appeasing the people, they were probably bringing peace, perhaps back to the community. But I don't get the feeling that it stayed that way. I'm talking about the peace, because they continued to make disciples. So I feel like, I wonder if down the road it comes up that they're still turning the world upside down. What are we going to do about this? What can we do about this? And, well, there's really nothing they can do.
They continued to fight against it and tried to resist it until, you know, wrath came down from on high on them. But, I mean, as far as, like, them being able to stop it, they couldn't, of course, ultimately prevail against God's plan. As the wise old Gamaliel had counseled the Sanhedrin with, as much authority, as much power and position that the Sanhedrin had, that was a Jewish Supreme Court, basically. And they themselves could not stop it from being taught in Jerusalem, let alone in the rest of the land of Israel. But they couldn't stop it in their homeland. They're definitely not going to be able to stop it here in a foreign city where many Gentiles have believed.
Yeah. You know, and it brings on the thought there, you know, the next thought there, what does it mean that they have turned the city or turned the world upside down mean?
Yeah, it's an interesting statement.
There's a started a movement that has that's turning people away from Judaism, number one. It's also turning people away from worldism, and it's also turning people away from thinking that the government is the answer. Have you ever thought about it from that perspective? Because they were probably at this time, you know, if you're a Roman providence, you were made to be dependent on the Roman government. I mean, that's the way it was set up. It's set up for you to be dependent on it. So now we're trying we're pulling people away from it.
Slaves and peasants on the bottom, and then you had, you know, people that were middle income that had successful businesses a little bit higher up. And then above them, you have people that are politicians and leaders and dignitaries and authorities of different kinds. A rare word that's used in the book of Acts, which made them think that Luke didn't know what he was talking about, was, how gracious, where does it appear? I'm trying to remember the word. There's a certain word that's used. I can't remember if it's this chapter or another chapter, but you know what I'm talking about?
No, I'm not following you on that one.
It's only used like one time in the entire book of Acts, and it's speaking about group of authorities and authority figures that lived in the first century, but nobody knew anything about them. But then some archaeology revealed they were doing digs and stuff over in these areas, and they found an inscription that had that same word confirming that these were real authorities.
That I remember what you're talking about now, but I can't remember what the word is used.
Asiarchs or something like that. It's like Asiarchs or something. And it's a strange word, but you're like, you never hear it anywhere outside of the Bible until they found it.
Until they did an archaeological dig.
This really was real. This shows you this was written in the first century too. Like, Luke's account, it wasn't written later. It was written in the first century. It had to, because the Asiarchs didn't continue on down through history.
It was a first century thing, so it had to be there.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But
the turn of the world upside down was just them, and just the introduction of Christ. It's a new way. It's a new way of living. It's a new way of looking at things. It's a new way it's just a new way of everything. You know, if you think about it, before Christianity, if you saw someone who was merciful, how were they looked, a leader especially, how were they looked upon? As a wimp.
Yeah,
They didn't understand
the people, like, you know, it seemed like they were stooping down because they didn't typically go about it the right way.
Love, mercy, peace, or offering peace, offering mercy, all these things that are Christian attributes were introduced by Christianity into the world. That would turn the world upside down. People, after they saw that it was a better way, then they, you know, it was more adopted. But far as the governments go, I mean, this is something totally foreign to them.
Yeah. What do you think about when Jesus sums up his ministry? He talked to his disciples, specifically his apostles, and told them, the Gentiles, the rulers that are over Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and their great ones, or benefactors, exercise authority over those that are under them. But so shall it not be among you. He that is greatest among you, let him be your servant. Or he that is great among you, let him be your servant. He that is greatest, let him be servant of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto. That's not to say he didn't get ministered unto, because women and disciples alike ministered unto him. But he didn't come to be ministered unto, but to minister, to serve. So yeah, that idea, that paradigm of serving is true greatness. The willingness to serve. And that principle is embodied even in our Constitution. The idea of serving being great, a form of greatness, and the willingness to step up into that office. Our politicians today have forgotten that. And that's why they stay politicians their whole life and start taking these bribes under the table. They're trying to line their pockets, make money, and use their power and influence for their own means and for their own ends. But in reality, they were supposed to serve. They were supposed to serve the interests of the American people. But somewhere along the way, a lot of politicians lose sight of that original purpose. And get blinded from it. But that's definitely turning the world upside down, because that's taking the hierarchy and flipping it over completely. He that's the lowest, as far as he that's the greatest person among you, is going to be the lowest. Is going to be the servant of all. Most people consider servants as the lowest of the low, slave.
Yeah.
I mean, people today don't even want to be called that or references that. Black people today don't want us to really talk about that, in the sense, because, like, you know, if you talk about Romans 6, it's almost better if you don't use the word slave, because of the fact people are easily offended by that word. So yeah, it's one of those things that is very offensive to people's ears to hear that slavery is the best way. But that's kind of what serving is. It means you are bound to that person. We think of serving as optional. I'll serve when I want to serve. You know, most people try to approach serving from that perspective, from that paradigm. That is not at all what Jesus means, though. You're going to be his servant. That means you're his slave. It literally means a bond servant. You're under his bondage. You're under his charge. You are a slave to Jesus. And if you're not willing to be, you should have never taken up the cross and followed it. And so people lose sight of that. Most people don't understand that message. Most Christians, as you know, you come in contact with, they don't, members of the Lord's Church, they don't understand that principle. Like, most people take the approach of, I'll serve Jesus when it's convenient for me, and I'll, you know, whatever. And so people lose sight. They get blinded to the reality of our calling and how comprehensive it is in its scope.
Yeah, you also think about this idea of service, being a servant and so forth, and how that Christianity is, in a way, it supports the ideal, because we're called to be servants. We're called to be slaves, actually, as you said. I know I've had people here in the past that, you know, it's like, well, I don't like that new translation you use, because there was a while I was using the ESV extensively. And they didn't slave. They didn't. I actually got approached by one person. I don't like that word slaves. That just don't. That has a negative connotation to it. And I said, well, not in the way that it's being used in Scripture. We're called to be slaves if we're not willing to give our all, as we read in that passage in Matthew 10. We're not ready.
I may have to do a lesson on that before long, because I really do think people don't want to see Christianity that way and in that light. But Christianity isn't something that, when you're in the mood to be a Christian, like every now and then if you feel like doing good, you should do good. And then on days you don't want to do good, you want to do absolute evil, that's okay too. That's not true. There's nothing further from the truth than that. And so, you know, it means you're a slave. It means you are bought with a price. When Jesus bought you with the price of his blood, that means he owns you. You're his property.
Yep.
You're his goods.
Yep.
You're his servant, bond servant. So yeah, it's one of those things people don't want to see that. They don't want to hear that because they don't want obedience.
Well, they don't understand that happiness comes from service. The dedication. The happiness is where, you know, happiness and comes from us slaving ourselves out to Christ.
But that doesn't sound true, though, Brian. but tell me the truth, though. When you're off work for a while, do you not get depressed?
Well, that's different.
If I'm off work for long enough, like these 2 weeks I've been off for Christmas break, I don't mind, because I've been staying pretty busy, you know, and I've had some days where I get to enjoy resting and sleeping in. That's great. I enjoy that every now and then. But that being said, if I'm off work for long enough, I start getting depressed, because man was created to work,
to serve.
And somewhere down through the time in history, we've forgotten that idea.
Well, if you think about it,
it's Satan's pride. He is unwilling to serve God. And we don't need to adopt that spirit of pride.
If you think about it, that's what made this country great.
Yeah.
Was people willing to work.
Yeah.
Everybody, not just a handful.
Yeah, sacrifices that were made. I mean, that's what makes anything great, is when you dedicate time and you sacrifice and you labor to accomplish something.
And what makes it even better is having other people who are working just
as
hard.
On the same side as you.
Yeah.
And working just as hard.
Fellow laborers.
That makes it even better. That makes the labor sweeter when you see somebody working with you in the field and they're working just as hard as you, and y'all are both getting it done. I mean, if you're plowing a road or hoeing a road and trying to get that ground broken up, and your buddy's right there with you, cooking along with you, it doesn't matter. It could be building a house. It doesn't have to be working in the field. It could be anything. But you take courage when you see others laboring. And that's why I think the church doesn't grow as much today, because we don't get to see each other do that much labor. We don't get to see each other in action in the world as much. And, you know, mission work in your local congregation is pretty stifled for the most part. So most people don't gather together to go door knocking or do set up Bible studies with people that often, you know, as much as we perhaps should, at least showing an effort to our community around it. So it's one of those things where brethren get discouraged because of that, and it keeps people from growing. But anyway, I'm rambling. I know it's time to stop it. Yeah, I think I'm going to have to do a sermon on that sometime.
Well,
or you can do a sermon Sunday. I don't care.
Well, the idea, just the idea of a servant is the right, you know, it's the right idea. You go back to the Old Testament, you know, where he talks about the dedication of the one that gets the awl put in their ear, and, you know, that kind of servitude. And also it goes the other way too, you know, those that are the masters have instruction to treat their servants correctly and treat it right. So it's a two-way street there, but we need to remember, and these people, you know, back to where we're talking about tonight, these people, you know, that were dragged out before the magistrates or before the leaders of the city, no telling what happened to them, you know, before they were secured. I could, you know, do you think they just, you know, they come in to get them out of the house, you think they just walked them out? You think they drug them out? The scripture, the King James Version uses a different word, but if you go back to the Greek, the word there is dragged. It's a forceful word. They dragged them out. And so they went kicking and screaming. So, so those people had to have a dedication the attitude of a servant, or they wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, they were so.
They were not would have done that.
And
they'd have given in.
It does show that Christianity's moral ethic authority does supersede human authority and earthly authority. Because there were some things that they were taught to do contrary to the decrees of Caesar. Not everything, but there were some things. You know, Gentiles that were converted had to know they could not offer incense and sacrifice to Caesar, whether he demanded it or not. They knew that. In the process of the teaching, somewhere down the line, Paul made it known that there were certain things that you could not yield obedience to in men anymore.
Yep. Well, we'll stop here and pick up with that with the Bereans next week.